So this session is about mind-body interactions in diabetes. One of the things that got me interested in the whole field of consciousness-based medicine, because my own personal training was first in internal medicine, and then after that I was a fellow in metabolism and diabetes and endocrinology at Harvard and at the Joslin Clinic, which is probably the world's premier place for complicated diabetic situations. And if anyone in this country has very severe, complicated diabetes with complications such as blindness or kidney disease, difficult to control diabetes, and they have the resources, they usually end up in Joslin Clinic in Boston. And I was a fellow over there, and I would sometimes be totally perplexed because you'd see two people who had the same kind of diabetes getting the same kind of treatment, and yet one person would be blind, have severe kidney disease, need a kidney transplant, or be on a dialysis machine, and then the other person, same age, same disease, same kind of diabetes, same kind of treatment, was doing completely well. No blindness, no kidney disease, and extraordinarily good health. When I saw that, that was the first time I began to wonder, you know, how come you can give the same kind of treatment to two people with exactly the same disease and see completely different outcomes? This is not just diabetes. It's true of many diseases. Heart disease, you have two patients with the same degree of myocardial infarction, and one gets all kinds of complications and dies in the coronary care unit, and the other recovers and goes home. So there is much more to medicine than we think. We've been taught to think that all illness is due to a pathogenic agent, a pathogen, whether it's a virus or a bacteria or a carcinogen or some kind of trauma, causes the disease. Well, it turns out that's not the case. A pathogen never causes the disease. A pathogen may be a precipitating factor in a susceptible host. And what makes one person more susceptible and what makes another person more resistant to the same onslaught from the environment is sometimes what makes the difference between life and death. So diabetes is a big problem in this country. There are at least 8 to 10 million diabetics at any one time being treated in the population of the United States. Of these, about 1 to 2 million approximately have what is called type 1 diabetes, and the remaining have what is called type 2 diabetes. And there's a small percentage of people who have something called type 3 diabetes. Type 1 diabetes is also called juvenile onset diabetes because it's usually frequently found in young people, even children. A child could come down with type 1 diabetes, a teenager, a young adult, and sometimes, rarely, it also occurs in later life. And type 1 diabetes is usually due to insulin deficiencies. There's a lack of insulin in the body. The pancreas is the organ which produces insulin, which is a hormone that takes sugar. And if you're a physician, please excuse the simplicity with which I'm explaining this, but it's really important that everybody participate in this lecture. So insulin is a hormone which takes sugar and converts it into storage, into something called glycogen or into fat in your body. It's a storage hormone. It stores sugar so you can use it later when you don't have access to food. And glucose is one of the most basic nutrients. And when you have lack of insulin, then your blood sugar goes up. And if it goes up a lot, then it spills into the urine. And now there's evidence that it gets transferred into some toxic kinds of metabolites, which then damage things like eyes, kidneys, nerves, blood vessels. So diabetes is the most common cause for blindness. It's also the most common cause for kidney failure. The most common cause why people have to go in dialysis or get kidney transplants. It's also a very high risk factor for atherosclerosis or hardening of the arteries. It's also a risk factor for heart disease or people getting heart attacks. And type 1 diabetes is the kind of diabetes that people get when they have lack of insulin. And this lack of insulin usually manifests in young life. And if people have type 1 diabetes before the 1930s, before insulin was discovered, then they would die in their youth. They would die in their 20s. Since insulin has been discovered, of course, people do survive, but they still go on to develop heart disease and blindness and kidney disease and neuropathy and atherosclerosis, frequently need to have their limbs amputated. So the complications of diabetes are horrendous. In fact, in medical school we were taught that if you understood everything that goes with diabetes, then you start to know everything in medicine, because it affects every system in the body. It affects your cardiovascular system, it affects your eyes, it affects kidneys, it affects the nerves, it affects muscle, it causes damage almost everywhere. And if you really understood all that happens with diabetes, you probably understand everything that could possibly go wrong in the human body. The cause of type 1 diabetes is now known. There's first of all a genetic predisposition to it. If there are identical twins and one has diabetes, then it's 50% likely that the identical twin will also have it. But not 100%. That tells us something too. Why only 50% if they're identical twins? So there must be something in the environment that predisposes people to that. And it's now felt that that something in the environment is some kind of infection in youth, a viral infection, possibly even something as simple as mumps or some other virus, influenza, mumps, that causes some kind of damage in the system. It results in what is called an autoimmune reaction, where there are antibodies that build up in the system to the islet cells. Islet cells are cells in the pancreas which produce insulin. So they start destroying these islet cells, and then you have an insulin deficiency. In fact, there are now tests that people can do, antibody tests, in children. And with reasonable accuracy, you can predict that this child may develop diabetes in the future if they get an infection, a viral infection. And, you know, viral infections are pretty common and easy to get. It used to also be thought, and wasn't clear, at least when I was taking my training, is the damage that happens in diabetes directly due to blood sugar, or is it something, some other metabolic disorder? And now more and more people believe that the damage that happens in the body is actually directly related to the blood sugar level. So the more control you have, the more you can maintain blood sugar within normal levels or close to normal levels, the less likely it is that you will get these complications. So that's type 1 diabetes. It's not as common as the other kind of diabetes, which is type 2 diabetes, which is also called maturity onset diabetes because it occurs in later life. It occurs usually in the late 30s or 40s or even later. And maturity onset diabetes happens to be a completely different kind of disease. Here, instead of too little insulin, there is too much insulin. But it doesn't work. For some reason, even though there's a lot of insulin in the body, it's not working effectively. And over the last several years, last couple of decades, it's become clear that what's happened in these cases is that there is a resistance at the level of the cell to insulin. So there is insulin resistance. The receptor that binds insulin, remember a receptor is like the lock into which your key fits. So think of insulin as the key that opens the door to a cell, which has to then metabolize glucose. The insulin, which is a neuropeptide, does not fit into the receptor for some reason. Most people with type 2 diabetes also have obesity. They're heavy. They are overweight. And if they lose weight and achieve normal weight, then the diabetes goes away. And they do reasonably well. So there's a direct link between obesity and type 2 diabetes and insulin resistance. How obesity creates insulin resistance, no one knows. There's too much insulin. Now, if type 2 diabetes is left untreated, it has the same, if not more, incidence of complications than type 1. It's as dangerous. It can lead to blindness, leads to kidney failure, leads to heart attacks, leads to atherosclerosis, leads to aneurysms, leads to hypertension, leads to neuropathy. People might have to get their limbs amputated. There is no difference in the rate of complications with type 2 diabetes. It's a bad disease, really bad disease. And yet, in a sense, unlike type 1 diabetes, traditional medicine holds that type 2 diabetes is curable if obesity could be curable. But of course, obesity is also a very difficult thing and frustrating thing to treat. Type 1 diabetes is also called insulin-dependent diabetes because anyone with type 1 diabetes usually needs insulin injections, not only once a day, but several times a day in order to maintain the blood sugar close to normal levels since there's insulin deficiency. Type 2 diabetes is not insulin-dependent because you already have a lot of insulin. It just doesn't work. So if you give somebody lots of insulin, it doesn't do anything in type 2 diabetes. And in fact, if somebody has type 2 diabetes for a long, long time, and the pancreas then gets exhausted, it puts out all this insulin, it doesn't work, and ultimately type 2 diabetes can lead to insulin deficiency also, and start behaving like type 1 diabetes. There is an 80% incidence of diabetes in identical twins. So if one person has diabetes and the identical twin has an 80% likelihood. So it's even more genetically determined than type 1 diabetes. And then there's something called type 3 diabetes, which is also called maturity onset diabetes in the young, which means the person who gets it is a young person, even a teenager, but it behaves like type 2 diabetes. They're obese, they are insulin resistant. And type 3 diabetes is found in India very frequently. It's also found amongst the American Indian tribes, particularly the Pima Indians. And in Pima Indians, the incidence is so high, it's about 60 to 70% of the Pima Indian population in Arizona has type 3 diabetes, which is insulin-resistant diabetes occurring at a young age. Same incidence of complications. So, it's a huge kind of problem. It's one of the commonest risk factors for heart disease as well. Is there any connection between what's happening in your mind, in your consciousness, and A, the incidence of diabetes, and B, the complications of diabetes, and C, the precipitating event that results in somebody who's predisposed to actually getting diabetes? And the answer is yes. There are all kinds of very interesting studies. In fact, somebody did a study among the Pima Indian population in Arizona as I told you, they have a 60% incidence. By the time they grow into adulthood, you have a 60% incidence or 70% incidence of overt diabetes in the Pima Indians. So there was this research study which they went to this American Indian tribe and they took young people who had no diabetes, no evidence of diabetes, and actually had them do a mathematical test which was computer generated. Every 5 minutes they have to solve the mathematical test. And at the same time the machine makes a very irritating noise. And just the frustration of doing that, the anxiety and the frustration, the blood sugar went up, many cases precipitated overt diabetes immediately after that. So it shows that in a person who's genetically predisposed, even minor degrees of stress will start to elevate blood sugar and start to precipitate the clinical appearance of that diabetes. And of course, when you're under stress, there are two kinds of things that happen. Diabetics have to be very careful about the amount of food they eat. They have to be very careful about the kind of food they eat. They have to be very careful about their insulin dose or other medication they're taking. They have to be very careful about exercise. All these have to be monitored. And if you're under stress, then you're not going to be doing that. You just don't comply as well. So that's the indirect way that stress affects diabetes. But the direct way is really a much more obvious route to how what happens in your consciousness influences the incidence of diabetes. Any of these experiences in consciousness, which we'll call stress, fear, hostility, guilt, depression, anxiety and anger, they have a direct effect on these two hormones, adrenaline and cortisol. These are hormones that are secreted by your adrenal gland. So anytime you feel stressed, adrenaline goes up and cortisol goes up. And adrenaline and cortisol have an effect on these other hormones, particularly glucagon, which is an antagonist of insulin, also produced by the pancreas, so it antagonizes the effects of insulin, and also growth hormone goes up, which is an antagonist of insulin. And so, first of all, there's either absolute or insulin deficiency, either the pancreas is not producing insulin, or even if it is, it's not working, and now you have all these insulin antagonists being secreted, that causes the blood sugar to go up, and that causes the onset of diabetes. So it's very clear, at least it makes scientific and logical sense, that if a person is having anxiety or stress or anything else happening in their consciousness that is perceived as a threat to them, one of the simplest definitions of stress in Western medicine is stress is the perception of threat. It's the perception of threat. Physical threat, psychological threat, financial threat of any kind of perception of threat. And stress doesn't exist in the environment. Stress doesn't exist in you. Stress is your interpretation of what's happening to you. It's an interpretation. I once heard Ken Pelletier, who's a researcher at Stanford, he said, stress is like the waves on an ocean. If you are unprepared, then the first one is disaster. And if you're a skillful surfer, then everyone is exhilarating. So it's your interpretation of what's happening in your environment. And when you have that, it really influences both the incidence, the onset, the precipitation, and the complications of diabetes. And so it's almost now 20 years ago that I started to get very interested in seeing how there was perhaps a better way to manage diabetics than just to give them insulin, oral medication, give them the right diet, the right prescription, etc. All these are important things. Because if you don't treat diabetes really carefully, you're going to end up with a patient at a very young age with all kinds of problems. And of course, increased mortality as well. So how do you decide where stress management, meditation, biofeedback really helps? This is also what we were doing at Joslin Clinic. We started to take patients with diabetes and we would measure their blood sugar frequently, and we would also monitor their stress levels on a scale of 1 to 10. And you can do that either subjectively, which is you ask the patient, you say, if you're really feeling totally calm and relaxed, that's a level 1. And if you're so jittery that you can't even sit still for a second and you're full of anxiety, that's a level 10. You can self-monitor your stress level. But there's another way of doing it these days, and that is through biofeedback. And I don't know how familiar you are with biofeedback. All kinds of very interesting biofeedback instruments available these days. We're in the process of setting up a biofeedback lab at our center, which will be monitoring brain waves, monitoring heart wave coherence, monitoring body temperature, heart rate, skin resistance, the amount of sweat you have in your skin, etc., etc. There are many ways of monitoring stress in your body. But one of the simplest ways that has been used traditionally in the so-called lie detector test is what you do is you monitor the resistance in the skin to the flow of electricity. And if somebody is very, very, very stressed, then what happens is their skin resistance decreases. The resistance in their skin to the flow of electricity decreases, which means electricity flows faster in the skin if you're very highly stressed. And if you're very relaxed, then your skin resistance to the flow of electricity increases. Electricity flows slower. And you can monitor that. You can feed that information into a machine. And if the skin resistance is low, which means you're stressed, then the machine makes a big noise. And if the skin resistance is high, which means you're not that stressed, then the machine doesn't make that big noise. And you can actually calibrate both the noise and can calibrate other things, so you can actually measure skin resistance, flow of electricity, and say how stressed a person is. So that's a very convenient way, and the technology is getting better and better, of teaching a patient to monitor their own stress levels. And at the same time, patients are taught how to monitor their blood sugar level. And if you see something like this, where stress level and blood sugar level are not related, then you know that this patient is not going to, his diabetes or her diabetes is not being influenced by what's happening in their consciousness. But if you see something like this, where the blood sugar and the stress levels parallel each other, then you know for sure that this is a kind of person who would enormously benefit just by practicing meditation. And this is what we started to do in Joslin Clinic. Take patients with really complicated diabetes, impossible to manage, and teach them a meditation technique twice a day. 15 minutes to 20 minutes, sitting quietly, doing a mantra, primordial sound meditation, something similar, or doing other kinds of meditation. But our experience mostly is with primordial sound meditation. What starts to happen is that many other people have done these studies. Dr. Benson at Harvard has done studies teaching some other kind of relaxation response. People have done studies teaching other kinds of meditation like mindfulness, breathing techniques, etc., with similar results. You start to see immediately that the diabetes is easier to control, and as a result of that, you have a decreasing incidence of complications as you follow these people over a period of time. there is some correlation between type 2 diabetes and depression, and you should always be looking out for that, because depression in type 2 diabetes and in adults can masquerade. It doesn't, you know, just because we're using the word depression doesn't mean that a person is sad all the time. Depression is not always manifested by the experience of sadness. The symptoms of depression can be very, very misleading. A change in appetite, inability to concentrate, a loss of memory, insomnia, especially waking up early in the morning or in the middle of the night. These can all be symptoms of depression. One should be looking for that in type 2 diabetes, because there's a definite correlation between the two. You need to treat the depression as well. Also, in type 1 diabetes, which frequently occurs in the young, frequently you'll see young teenagers with type 1 diabetes who at the same time have anorexia or bulimia or an eating disorder. I'm just mentioning this because it makes it very difficult to treat these people unless you're addressing that as well. Okay, and there is some evidence that if you have type A personality, it's difficult to control diabetes as well. So these are the mind-body treatments that have been employed in the treatment of diabetes. It's almost unforgivable, I think, if a patient with diabetes is not monitoring their own blood sugar levels and not taught how to do that, because in the absence of self-monitoring, it's almost impossible to get good control of their blood sugar. It's almost unforgivable if they're not monitoring their stress levels, because stress plays a crucial role in the management of diabetes. This is one category of patients that should definitely all be using a biofeedback instrument to monitor that. And you can teach them all these wonderful techniques of all the techniques we mentioned yesterday, like the sound technique through attention and intention. You can teach them breathing techniques. You can teach them simple meditations, link it to aromatherapy, etc. And you suddenly start to see that they get convinced that it is really helping their disease, because they see the effect when they measure their blood sugar. They see the effect when they use the biofeedback instrument. It's so obvious to them that these are the perfect candidates for biofeedback training as well. Stress management techniques, usually here I'm talking about meditation, but there are so many other things that help during stress. And just briefly, and just a list of other things that you can do to improve a person's condition when they're under extreme stress. The traditional things that have been used are laughter therapy, of course exercise, massage, visualization, music, changing environment. All these are effective ways of managing stress. Diet, I want to talk to that for a few minutes, because the diet that you give in type 1 diabetes is very different from the diet that you would give in type 2 diabetes. Type 1, from an Ayurvedic perspective, type 1, if you look at the patient, they are insulin deficient. They have a lot of the classic symptoms of diabetes, which traditionally are polyuria, which means lots of urine, because the sugar goes out through the kidneys, it's filtered, and with it it takes a huge water load. Polyuria, lots of urination. Polydipsia, lot of thirst. And polyphagia, feeling hungry all the time. That's because even though they're getting all this nutrition, they just can't use it. The insulin is not working. So those are the classic symptoms of especially type 1 diabetes. Polyuria, polydipsia, polyphagia. And you know, this was described 6,000 years ago by a great rishi called Sushruta, who was also the most important plastic surgeon of Ayurveda. It seems in India about 4,000 to 6,000 years ago, during the time of Sushruta, there was a law that if somebody was found guilty of adultery, they would chop their nose off. And Sushruta had the best plastic surgery practice. He used to do rhinoplasties. He used to do nose jobs. This is at least 4,000 years ago. And his textbooks are still available, and they show the 105 types of nose jobs that he did. And he used to take leaves from a peepal tree, and he used to do all his models of the different types of shapes that he could do, the different types of rhinoplasties that he could do. So he was a great plastic surgeon. But he was also a great physician. He described diabetes. And in his book, which is called the Sushruta Samhita, which is in two volumes, and still, we still use it when we study Ayurveda, thousands of years later, the whole book is in the form of poetry, because he was a rishi. And he described every disease that is known to man in the form of poetry. He sung it. So if you wanted to become an Ayurvedic physician during Sushruta's time, you went to a school and you learned music, you learned singing, you learned the poetry, and in the end you knew everything. So here's how the symptoms of diabetes are described in English. I'm going to translate that. But when you hear it in Sanskrit, it's a song. But even in English, it sounds great. It says, eating but always hungry, drinking but always thirsty, the poor patient watches his flesh melt away in a stream of sugary urine. That's the description of type 1 diabetes from the writings of Sushruta 4,000 years ago. And that he described as a vata disorder. He said type 1 is really a vata disorder, because what you see is a hypermetabolic state. The patient is eating, but he's always hungry. The patient is drinking water, but always thirsty. And all his flesh is melting away in a stream of sugary urine. He says it's a vata disorder, and you should be treating it as a vata disorder. And he also described type 2 diabetes, which is a hypometabolic disorder. Even though the symptoms or the complications are the same, the blindness and all these complications, he said that this is a kapha disorder, because here, you know, the patient is obese, they're not metabolizing the fat in their body, they're slow, they're phlegmatic. And, of course, he didn't use the word insulin resistance or anything, because that's a biochemical concept. Remember, this is a consciousness-based model. He said there's another type of diabetes, that is a kapha balancing program is required. So when it comes to diet, and this morning you learned a lot about diet, in type 1 diabetes, you actually give people a vata balancing diet. And a vata balancing diet is sweet, sour, and salt, which intuitively at first time you say, gosh, are you going to give type 1 diabetes sugar? But remember, sweet doesn't mean just sugar, it means all complex carbohydrates. And now there is a lot of good data that supports that. That in fact, in type 1 diabetes, you give high-load carbohydrate diets, and that makes it much easier to manage these people, because you can monitor the insulin and so on. In type 2 diabetes, on the other hand, you give a kapha balancing diet, which is the diet which has astringent, bitter, pungent tastes, and helps you mobilize kapha, helps you treat obesity. So at this time, it is very clear that the type of diet that you give to diabetics, and type 3 you would treat as type 2 anyway, because it's a majority onset type of diabetes in the young, through a kapha balancing diet. So it's now very clear that there are two different kinds of diet programs for diabetes. Not every diabetic is given exactly the same diet. Diet is according to body type. Now, in addition, what you can give is nutritional supplements, particularly to type 2 diabetics, because if you give them kapha balancing nutritional supplements, which are these herbal combinations that have astringent, bitter, and pungent taste, then you will speed up their metabolism. If you give them kapha balancing herbal tea, you'll speed up their metabolism. And the same thing is true. If you give vata balancing herbal tea or vata balancing herbal powders in type 1 diabetes, you will begin to slow down their metabolism. What about exercise? Again, exercise is a very, very important factor in the treatment of diabetes. But in vata body types, which is type 1 diabetes, you have to be very careful, because if you overdo your exercise, and these people are extremely sensitive to insulin, remember they are insulin deficient, you can immediately cause what is called a hypoglycemic episode or hypoglycemic coma, which if it is not treated immediately can lead to brain damage and even death. So even though exercise is an important part of the program in type 1 diabetes, very mild exercise. On the other hand, in type 2 diabetes, you prescribe very heavy exercise because of their insulin resistance. So we all know that obesity is not easy to treat, but from an Ayurvedic perspective, if you pay attention to a few things, it actually is not that difficult to treat. From an Ayurvedic perspective, the way you treat obesity is as follows. Most important, eating awareness, eating in silence. Because as you begin to eat in silence, you begin to find that your body, first of all, becomes so sensitive to food, and you're allowing your body to listen and respond to food, that spontaneously you have a different level of satiety. Your satiety threshold, which is the satisfaction that you get from food, changes just by doing that. Just by doing that. The second thing is paying real attention to a kapha balancing diet, which will speed up the metabolism. And if you add the appropriate spices, if you add the appropriate herbal combinations, and frequently prescribe kapha balancing herbal tea like several times a day, that will keep the metabolic rate at a higher level, so it will also help. A kapha balancing diet, kapha balancing nutritional supplements, eating awareness. And another thing that helps is what we call, and maybe David has spoken to you about this, the hot water regime or hot water treatment. Has he spoken to you about this? Okay, so you ask the patient to every morning to fill up a thermos with boiling hot water or ginger water or water with a little lemon. You fill it up, but really make it hot and boiling. And then you instruct the patient that every half an hour, they take a few sips of it. It's not even the amount, it's the frequency. And you also tell them to look at their tongue in a mirror. And what you ask them to monitor, and this is a very simple Ayurvedic way of monitoring toxins in the body, is that if they have a lot of toxins in the body, ama, you know what ama is, right? AMA. Okay. If they have a lot of toxins in the body, if they have a lot of ama in the body, then their tongue will be coated and muddy and their breath will be stale and not pleasant. If there is no ama in the body, then your tongue is pink and moist and your breath feels fresh. So it's that simple to monitor ama. So you prescribe this hot water, either ginger water or lemon water or plain hot water, boiling hot, every half an hour. And as they begin to drink it every half an hour, they also monitor the ama. They'll find that several things will happen. First, as the ama is mobilized, they'll see that their tongue gets even more muddy and coated. Breath starts feeling quite stale and they get fatigued. But as they continue to do it, and they may get joint pains and arthralgias, pains in the joints, fatigue, muscle weakness. But as that continues to be mobilized, may take a day, 2 days, or 3 days, then as their tongue becomes pink and moist, their breath starts to smell fresh and they feel lots of energy. And one of the things that interferes with your metabolic rate is that if there is too much ama in your system, your metabolic rate is slow. So when the ama is removed, metabolic rate starts to come up. And in fact, we found that those patients who have resistance to losing weight, despite everything, you know, you're practicing eating awareness, they're practicing kapha pacifying diet, they're taking the kapha balancing herbal combinations, and still it doesn't seem to be working, you start them on this little simple routine with hot water, not fasting or anything, this is just an addition to their daily activity. Within 2-3 days, they suddenly start to mobilize food and fat and fluid from their body. They start to lose weight. It's one of the most effective things you can do for somebody who's really frustrated and not losing weight. You can add this to their regimen. It's a good thing, by the way, to do for any patient with any chronic illness. You want to get ama out. So it's a good thing to do. And remember, when you start this, you tell them maybe do it for 2 days a week or 3 days a week. And if you're a vata body type and you have a chronic illness, then be very careful, because I've had patients who have vata body type and, you know, I've told them you can start this hot water routine and they find suddenly, you know, how vatas are, they get more energetic even more than they have, and they find that their symptoms are good, so they get over enthusiastic about it. And soon they start to lose weight so rapidly that they become completely very thin and asthenic and dangerously so. So you have to be careful when you prescribe this, especially to a vata body type. Okay, what about herbs in diabetes? Most of the herbs that are used in diabetes are most effective in type 2 diabetes. We have never come across a case where in type 1 diabetes you could eliminate insulin altogether. But in fact, you can do wonderful things. You can reduce the dosage of insulin. You can reduce the frequency of insulin. You can really help these patients through herbs and diet and the Ayurvedic routine that I have mentioned. But in all cases, you'll still need a little bit of insulin. You know, I have had patients who have required 2 units of insulin, once in the morning, maybe 2 units in the evening, or maybe not even twice a day, 5 units once in the morning. So that kind of control can be achieved. And type 2 diabetes, excellent control can be achieved. Type 2 diabetes is much more common, has the same incidence of complications, therefore is a more important disease to treat. So the first herb that I want to talk about is called Meha Siringi in Sanskrit. And the Latin name is Gymnema silvestre. It's the original name in Sanskrit, means destroyer of sweet. And it's mentioned even in Sushruta's work thousands of years ago. And it's a very interesting herb. If you just take a little bit of it and put it on your tongue, you lose your sensation for sweetness for about an hour or 2 hours. Just by putting that herb on your tongue, I personally feel it's one of the most effective things for people who have sugar cravings, for people who have obesity and like to eat too many sweets, etc. So it's a very effective herb. You say, why isn't everybody using it? The answer is the pharmaceutical industry is not interested in this stuff because you can't patent it. You know, you cannot patent something that has too many ingredients. And so the pharmaceutical industry says there's no money in it. These things are very effective, okay? So it destroys the taste for sugar for a while. It decreases your appetite. It's useful in treatment of obesity. And in fact, there's some evidence that it may influence insulin receptor sites. The second herb that's used in Sanskrit, in Hindi, the name is Neem. And the Latin name is Azadirachta indica. It's very common in India. You actually can make a little concoction out of it and you drink it. It's very bitter and it has an effect on insulin receptor sites. And the third herb that is used is called Google. And we use Google for many, many reasons. What is Google? It's a resin. It does not get absorbed into the system. And it's one of the most frequently used preparations in Ayurveda for lowering cholesterol. And very effective. I have had cardiologists, given them samples, said cholesterol is a very difficult thing to treat. And the drugs that are used are pretty toxic. And yet Google will reduce as effectively as any drug, and sometimes even more, with no toxicity. And the beauty is it's not absorbed. So it has no toxicity whatsoever. Google is used for treatment of high cholesterol. It's also used for treatment of heart disease in combination with other herbs. We have a preparation here called OptiCardio, which contains Google and other things that are tonics for the heart. But the main effect is, again, lowering cholesterol. And then there's another preparation. The commercial name is Google Max. Okay. So that's probably one of the best things you can use for lowering cholesterol as well. Okay, then there's another herb called Gokshura, which is also essentially a bitter herb, and it's also used for diabetes 1 and 2. It's also a urinary tract detoxifier. It's an antiseptic. It's used for urinary tract infections. It's used in diabetes. Amlaki, which is the essential ingredient of biochavan, has many effects, antioxidant effects, has many beneficial effects. And finally, turmeric, which is a common thing used in cooking, is also very effective in changing insulin resistance. So these are some of the herbs that are used in diabetes. I know this lecture has been pretty technical for some of you, but it just shows you that using different approaches that combine very simple things, non-toxic things, can make a crucial difference between something that's really life-threatening, that causes such intense morbidity, that can cause blindness and kidney disease and heart disease. And there are approaches that are totally easy, simple, and yet most physicians aren't even aware of them.
So we're continuing our exploration of our digestive system. And the first time I gave this talk, someone asked, what is a neurologist doing talking about the gut? And I said, well, that makes me sick to my stomach. I can't swallow that. It felt like it just kicked me in my gut. The gut is a remarkable system. And it's almost autonomous in that it has its own nervous system, it has its own endocrine system, it has its own immune system. And it really makes sense that there should be a lot of biological intelligence there, because like the skin and like the respiratory tract, the gut is really our interface between inner and outer environment. Now, we may think that the esophagus, the stomach, the small intestine, the large intestine is inside of us, but really it's the lining of this tube that's outside of us. It's that encapsulated space. So if something foreign is going to enter into our body, it's fairly likely it's going to come there through our digestive tract. And so it's important that we have the wisdom, the intelligence of the body focused on that area to select what we're going to allow in and to make certain that that which we don't want in is kept out. The digestive system has its own nervous system. It's called the enteric nervous system. It's not quite as big as the central nervous system with 100 million cells, but it has sensory, meaning nerves that bring information in, motor and associative connecting nerve cells. So you can actually disconnect the gut from the brain and it will still do a fairly good job of moving food along, regulating the secretion of hormones, regulating the flow of substrates and fluid back and forth across the gut. Although we usually think of the nervous system of the digestive tract as part of the autonomic nervous system, it actually functions a lot more like the central nervous system. There's a very precise feedback loop within the digestive tract. Now, the most important connection, neurological connection between the brain and the digestive tract is through the vagus nerve. The vagus nerve comes from a Latin word which means wandering. It wanders throughout the thorax and the abdomen, supplying information to the heart, the lungs, and really throughout the entire digestive tract. And for a long time it was thought that its primary role was to regulate motor activity, coordinate the digestive process. But as it turns out, the vast majority of fibers within the vagus nerve are actually bringing information from the digestive tract back to the brain. So it's really more of a sensory nerve monitoring and feeding that information back than it is bringing motor information, because as I said, it tends to be able to push things along pretty well on its own. It connects in this area of the brain stem called locus coeruleus, which means the dark blue spot, because when you stain it, it looks that way. And this is very closely connected, both anatomically and physiologically, to our centers of alertness, our centers of anxiety, our cardiovascular centers. So it's not surprising that when our minds are agitated, it has an effect on our digestive process. And it's not surprising that when our digestion is off, it has an effect on our cognitive process, on our thinking processes. Now, there are a lot of different chemicals, increasing numbers, that have been discovered in the gut and were called gut peptides. But as we now know, every one of these is also present in the nervous system. So it was called gastrin because it was discovered in the stomach, but gastrin has widespread distribution in the brain. If we would have found it in the brain, we would have called it something differently. Same thing for all these different hormones. And this number keeps increasing. Again, the same chemical codes that the brain uses to communicate with itself, with an immune system, communicates with our heart, with our digestive tract. The remarkable coordination of this chemical communication between mind and gut is really amazing. So if we take, for example, this gut hormone called CCK, cholecystokinin, what happens is when we ingest fat and it reaches the first part of our small intestine, small intestines release this chemical, cholecystokinin, which enters the circulation and then causes the gallbladder and the liver to a lesser degree to release bile so we can absorb that fat. So the first discovery of this is cholecystokinin, meaning the cholecyst, which is the gallbladder, is forced to release its bile. But subsequently discovered that the same chemical was localized in the brain, in the limbic system, which is responsible for emotions and feelings, and in the hypothalamus, where it seems to regulate satiety when we're full. So the wisdom of the body has used the same code to, one, absorb the fat, two, give us a sensation of pleasure in the brain and in our emotional system, and three, tell us when we've had enough so we stop eating. It's a remarkable, coordinated, nonlinear process. Another one is known as vasoactive intestinal peptide, VIP. And again, it's called vasoactive intestinal peptide because when it was initially discovered in the gut, it was thought to regulate the supply of blood to the gastrointestinal system. And of course, it's essential that we have good regulation because it's the blood that allows us to absorb the nutrients from whatever we've eaten and bring it to the rest of the body where it can be processed. But subsequently, we've learned that it has much wider effects. It induces the secretion of the pancreas, so it releases the pancreatic enzymes. It actually stimulates motility. It's initially defined as causing intestinal changes in intestinal blood flow. Something interesting is that it actually regulates the cardiovascular blood flow, that when VIP is secreted, it actually dilates coronary arteries. And a study that I don't think has been published yet, but was done at Ohio State University, did Ayurvedic massages on people and measured VIP levels, which rose and stayed elevated for actually several days. And PET scans looking at the heart of people who had these massages showed that there was improved blood supply through the coronary arteries, that the collateral blood flow increased. So, again, we tend to think about these hormones as being linear, but that's really not the way the body works. It's also, of course, in the GI system and in the cortex. Now, as I mentioned, The GI system, if you just take it on its volume, is probably the largest endocrine organ in the body. The GI system is lined with hormonal packets. And in addition, it's probably the largest immune system in the body. Because again, what's coming in? Foreign matter is always coming in. So we need to be alert to whether or not what's coming in is something that we want. As you know, most of our large intestine is lined with bacteria, which are fine and are actually helpful to us as long as they stay in the lumen of the gut, but we don't want them invading our system. So the immune cells are very lively there and are continuously regulating, continuing monitoring and responding to whatever packets of nourishment are coming in through the system. It's also this large immune system in the digestive tract is probably responsible to some degree for inflammatory bowel problems like ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, where this immune system gets overly activated. It's an autoimmune illness which causes quite a lot of serious inflammation in the small intestine and in the colon. Okay, so let's talk about a practical application of a very common disorder from a mind-body perspective. And that is functional bowel disorder. In fairly good studies, about 30% of American adult population at some point or another has distressing or disabling gastrointestinal symptoms. It could be that they feel they're not digesting their food properly, they get a lot of cramps or spasm or excessive gas, but it's a fairly common problem, and probably half of the visits to a gastrointestinal specialist ends up ultimately being diagnosed as functional bowel disease or irritable bowel syndrome. It accounts for a lot of visits to doctors and a ton of prescriptions. So it's a common problem, and it's probably really the bread and butter of a GI doctor's practice. Now, what is it? It's when people have abdominal pain, alteration in their elimination, usually alternating constipation and diarrhea, a sense of bloating, and despite every test that you can do structurally, upper and lower GI series where you put barium into the gut, or endoscopy where you actually look up there with fiber optic tools, everything looks fine. So it's not a structural problem, it's a functional problem. It's a lack of coordination, it's a lack of balance in the digestive system. Because the way that we're trained in Western medicine is if we can't see it, we don't believe it, there's been a tendency to think about people with irritable bowel or functional bowel disease as being psychosomatic in this pejorative way. And so they've done studies to try to figure out, well, what's different about people with irritable bowel than by people who don't have it. And the only really consistent finding is that if you increase the pressure in the gut in someone who has irritable bowel, they will perceive it at a much lower level of pressure than someone who doesn't. The way they do this is they put these little balloons into someone's colon or in their esophagus. They start to blow them up and they say, tell me the first time you can perceive this. And people who don't have this problem, these things can get pretty big before you notice that there's some pressure in the gut. But people with irritable bowel, they notice it at a very low level. So they have an increased sensitivity to distension in their digestive tract. Now, at first people say, well, these people are just basically wimps. That they're sensitive to everything. But it turns out that they're not. That there's other ways of testing a person's pain threshold. You can have people stick their hand in ice cold water, or you can see their threshold to other types of stimuli. And in every other way, they're actually as resilient to pain as anybody else. So it's something very specific. It's probably something to do with an inherited sensitivity in their nerve fibers. And as we know, it's probably a vata imbalance because vatas tend to be more nerve-oriented. It's quite common for people with this condition to have other types of health concerns. Fatigue is very common in people with irritable bowel. And nobody quite knows what comes first here. If you're dealing with this distressing digestive process, and you end up going to dozens of doctors and no one can help you, and you always get the sense that they're treating you as if you're making this whole thing up, and you're not eating that well because you're afraid that every time you eat you're going to get cramping or get bloating or have the runs and not be able to get to the bathroom in time, then it's not surprising that you might develop these other concerns, like fatigue, like chronic pain, like funny kinds of pains in the chest that often end up getting people admitted to coronary care units, getting angiograms, everything turns out to be normal. And there's also a tendency for certain psychological symptoms like anxiety, hostility, and general fearfulness. Now, Klein reported a few years ago on, I think, about 50 different studies trying pharmaceutical interventions for people with this condition. And as I mentioned, over 2 million prescriptions are given a year for this condition just in the United States. They tried things that reduced spasm, slowed down the motility of the gut, increased the bulk. They gave opiates like diiodide tincture of opium, antidepressants, tranquilizers. Again, looked at 50 different types of medications and came to the conclusion that not a single one of these medicines had ever been shown to be effective, even though they're passed out like candy. And so, seems like a fairly depressing problem. But, turns out that there's actually some fairly easy things to do about it. Studies that have primarily been done in Great Britain have shown that just simply teaching people a relaxation technique and then a guided visualization can often substantially improve the symptomatology of people with irritable bowel. So that if someone had the classical symptoms, cramping pain, irregularity in their bowel habits, and no structural problem, they actually reported 100% success of either complete or nearly complete resolution of symptoms through their simple relaxation and visualization procedures. If they had atypical symptoms, or that maybe they had pain but not cramping, maybe they had bloating but not pain, they still had over 40% of people responding. And even if people scored high on psychological testing of anxiety or depression, which other people have used as a reason why, of course, nothing works, it's all in their heads, they still had over a 60% success rate of substantial improvement from this very simple mind-body approach. Another study that was repeated a couple years later looked at total failures. People that no matter what had been done for them, they reported absolutely no improvement in their condition. And all they had these people do was participate in 4 40-minute relaxation procedures. That they had them sit down, I'll take you through it in just a minute, practice a simple meditation technique, visualize a certain normalization of their gut, and out of this group, the total number, 32 patients, 20 improved and 11 had complete remissions. You know, how much more cost effective can you make something? But are there irritable bowel clinics using mind-body approaches in the world? Very few. Very few. So let me tell you just a little bit about how we approach this condition. Most people that we, and we see a lot of people with a whole range of digestive disorders, and it can be quite severe. When I was a medical student at the University of Chicago, they had a whole irritable bowel clinic, which was probably the busiest clinic in the hospital. And it was to the point where people were afraid to go to restaurants, because anything they ate, they would get cramping or gas, and they'd have to go to the bathroom. It can be so bad that people are afraid to leave their houses. It can be so bad that except for rice and some very simple foods, that anything else sets them off. So if you had to say, in Ayurvedic terminology, what was this deficiency? What would you say? It's an Agni deficiency, right? It's a weakness of the ability to take in energy and information from the environment and convert it into the energy and information of our bodies. So there's not one thing that fixes people with irritable bowel, because most people with irritable bowel have a vata aggravation. They'll often tell you that, going back to my childhood, the dinner table was not a pleasant place to be. There was always arguing going on. There's always a tense environment. I wanted to get away from the table as quickly as possible. Or I was forced to eat even though I wasn't really hungry. So there's almost always, invariably, some subtler emotional issue associated with this whole eating process. And, you know, one of the few ways that children have to exercise some sense of control over their environment is what they eat. So it's quite common for emotional issues to be translated into physical symptoms in the digestive tract. So the first thing we always do, of course, is teach people meditation. And for many, it's the first time that they've actually been in their body and feel relatively comfortable for many years. The second thing that we routinely do is we put people on a very simplified diet. And there's a formula in Ayurveda known as khichdi. And basically all the khichdi is rice and mung bean dal. Mung bean is actually very readily available now in Indian food stores and in Middle Eastern food stores. And it's said to be the easiest lentil, the easiest legume to digest. It's often one of the first foods that infants are given when they start going from milk to solid foods. It feels very nurturing and it's very easy to digest. Cook it up like any kind of bean, like one part bean and three or four parts water. Make it into a light soup. Season it gently. And then you mix it in with rice that's been cooked. So the combination of mung dal and rice is what's called khichdi. And many of the Ayurvedic cookbooks have their own recipes. And it's fairly balanced because between the mung dal and the rice and then a little bit of steamed vegetables, you're able to really cover all the bases. We usually keep people on that for a couple weeks, just letting their digestive system rest. Then we begin to gradually work on improving their agnis. If they can tolerate it, we would start using ginger. But for some people with this problem, even ginger is too strong. It's too powerful. So then we use what are more of the warmer spices. Ginger is more in the hot spice category. And the warmer spices are cumin, coriander, and fennel. Cumin, coriander, and fennel. So we just start grinding that up and adding that to the khichdi. So there's a little bit of a spiciness to it, but not enough so that it's overwhelming to a person. Then we usually start to try to increase it further. So after a few weeks on that combination, cumin, coriander, and fennel, then we usually add the stronger spices. The combination in Ayurveda, which is the strongest agni enhancer, is called trikatu. T-R-I-K-A-T-U. Tri katu. Tri, you know, means three, and katu means pungent. So trikatu are the three pungents. And they consist of dry ginger, black pepper, and long pepper. So it's shunti in Sanskrit, marika in Sanskrit, and pipali. And one of the advantages of pipali is that, like fresh ginger, it has a sweet vipak. So it balances pitta. If it was only pungent, it would be very strong on pitta. But since its end effect is to have a little bit of sweetness, it ends up balancing the pitta so it doesn't get a person getting a lot of heartburn and indigestion along the way. Usually with this process, people begin to feel more confident that they can start to consume their environment. And so we gradually introduce more complex foods. Now, people may also tend to have difficulties with absorption. And there are a number of Ayurvedic herbs which are really most useful to balance the lower digestive tract. The most popular formula is called triphala, triphala, T-R-I-P-H-A-L-A. Tri means three, phala means fruit. So triphala, the three fruits, are amlaki, bibitaki, and haritaki. They're fruits that come from trees mainly grown in India, Tibet, and Nepal. And they are very tonifying to the digestive tract. In fact, each one has an effect on one of the doshas. What's great about triphala, if someone's loose, it will slow them down a little bit. If someone is slow and constipated, it will actually speed them up a little bit. It's very balancing to the digestive tract. You can take it as a powder, but it's pretty sour and astringent, so most people take it in the form of tablets. You can buy triphala now at almost any health food store. So with just some very simple interventions, something to start to increase the agni, something to stabilize the lower intestine, the bowel, teaching meditation, you can often start to see a dramatic improvement that people actually start to like food. And then, of course, teaching mindfulness eating is really powerful for people. Just as we, who presumably have fairly healthy digestive processes, don't pay that much attention, people who have these functional bowel problems, they're so afraid of their guts that it's as if they just put it in and hope for the best. And by getting them to really pay attention, eat consciously, get an intimate relationship with the food before it's truly intimate, can really enhance the quality of their digestive process.